From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made near the border of Pennsylvania and New York State in the Delaware River watershed back in 2008. That's when the gas industry proposed to drill gas wells across that region because it's rich with natural gas underground. Filmmaker Josh Fox lives along the banks of that river, and he felt like his community was under siege. Fox is a filmmaker behind the film Gasland, and now he's putting out a new film with a focus on climate change. Sort of. It's more about how we're already losing to climate change, and in some ways it feels like it's too late, so maybe we should focus on what we can do. The film has a long title. It's called How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. Here's what the New York Times wrote about the film. Quote, a one-word assessment of this documentary is tough, as in tough to watch, tough to consider, tough to ignore, end quote. The film is showing through tomorrow in Ithaca at the Cinemopolis, and it's showing on Saturday afternoon at the Little Theater. So we're going to be talking to the filmmaker coming up in just a moment. That's Josh Fox, who is the man behind the film. And also in studio, let me welcome my guest, Rachel Larson's here. She's a community solar catalyst for SED, that's Sustainable Energy Developments in Rochester. Rachel, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
And Brady Ferguson's here. He's a member of the Rochester chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Brady, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Before we get Josh Fox on the phone, Brady, you had a chance to see the film. And Rachel, I know you've had a chance to see at least part of the film. It's just over 2 hours, a little bit longer than the average documentary. But Brady, I found the film at times pretty dark, pretty, I don't want to say depressing, but very sobering. How did you take it?
Yeah, I think there was definitely some doom and gloom in the film. And that's because when you look at climate change and effects, there is a lot of there is some reason for people to feel hopelessness, but I like that midway through the film it took a turn and he tried to start looking for some hope and looking for some positives, and I like being optimistic, so I like that he was able to find some ways to take positive out of it.
About midway through the film, he essentially declares that he's kind of out of hope himself, that he thinks that there's really nothing to be done. But I agree with you that in the last hour of the film, he goes literally around the world looking for people who are doing things sometimes on a small scale that will change that with hope. So we'll talk about that coming up. Rachel, for you, I know the tone of the film, even the title of the film, can be pretty dark. Did you get a sense that it was pretty dark?
I did, Evan. I think also that he's kind of preaching to the choir. I feel like that we should be beyond learning that our climate is changing. If we don't know that already, it just is shocking to me.
Well, you are someone who has seen local action, which is one of the themes of the film, is looking at sort of, there's sort of a, I wouldn't call it a love note to local activism, but in many ways, I mean, don't you think, Brady? I think he was very appreciative of the efforts and the courage of activists, whether it's in communities in different countries, communities in our own country. I think he certainly has affection for them. But you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. A lot of it was just looking at individuals, looking at small groups, and just small actions that can be taken that can just give people hope with dealing with it.
And in this community, Rochester, I know, is working on its own climate action plan. Rachel's story is one that I kind of want to explore because you came to Rochester 7 years ago. Is that right?
I think, yes.
Okay, it's 2009.
Yes.
And you are an Oregonian.
Yes.
So you lived in Portland.
Yes.
And Portland is one of the places that we often hear is helping lead the way with local climate change activism, a local action plan. I want to know how you contrast what you saw there. And maybe 7 years ago was too long. Maybe a decade ago, Portland didn't have things going on, or maybe they did. What did you see there, and how do you sort of juxtapose that with what's going on here?
In Portland, I believe the government and as environmentalists in general really put a lot of thought and planning into everything that they did. So as a Portlander, you could compost and recycle from your curb. You can ride your bike practically everywhere and know that you will be safe.
That was an interesting caveat to throw in.
We're working on it in Rochester,
yeah.
But it just was easy to be an environmentalist. It's also easy to be a gardener there. It doesn't snow in Portland like it does here. So you plant any plant in your front yard and it grows to be 5 feet tall. So you feel like you're connected to the earth and nature. Here, you have to work it a lot harder. I think we are heading in the right direction. I'm excited for the folks that I've met here and the communities that I'm working with to change Rochester to be a more sustainable city. But we still have a long way to go. But that's where all the hope is. There's power in working together. And there's a lot of genuine, hardworking folks that are ready to do that work.
When you talk about being able to sort of compost from the curb, tell me a little bit more about that. And even though that seems like a small thing, the impact that has.
Well, it just makes everyone think about how much waste we generate and how much we're putting in the landfill. The landfill is a huge producer of methane gas, which is more carbon, more heating up in our atmosphere. So if you're thinking of, oh, I'm not finishing all this salad and I can just put it in a bin beside my sink and the city, the county picks it up for me and they make sure that it's composted, it doesn't take a lot of effort to know that every action we have has an impact, whether it's the food we buy, looking at the packaging to know, think about how much we're going to throw away, or walking to work. You know, everything makes a difference. And it's just in your face in Oregon.
Well, we're going to continue that part of the conversation a little bit later this hour. You're hearing Rachel Larson and Brady Ferguson in studio with us sharing their perspectives. And I want to welcome the filmmaker Josh Fox. Again, the film is called How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. That's a documentary that's showing on Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock at the Little Theater. It's also showing through tomorrow at the Cinemopolis in Ithaca. Josh, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, early in your film, you say that even though you can beat the fossil fuel industry in individual battles, and the film, appropriately enough, opens with you dancing like a maniac, celebrating one of those individual battles, that we could eventually lose everything we love to climate change. And that is pretty dark. Do you consider yourself an optimist, a pessimist, a realist?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. What I do know is that for the last 8 years, you know, I've spent traveling around working with people, showing my two films, Gasland Part 1 and Gasland Part 2, in over 300 cities, and working with people to fight fracking. And the fracking battles are mostly local battles that are all connected together by the fact that we're all being invaded in 34 states around the United States fighting off fracking. And people in New York know this well because it was a very controversial issue. And fracking, thankfully, was banned in the state of New York in an incredible and unprecedented and very important move by the Cuomo administration. So I am celebrating our victory against fracking in the beginning of the film. But yes, I realize that our hemlock forests are dying because of the woolly adelgid, which is marching up the coast from Virginia all the way up to Maine. It's a parasite that's eating those hemlock trees. That's a keystone species. We don't know what our forests look like in the Northeast without hemlocks. We don't know how they operate or how they behave. And we could lose everything we love to climate change. And then right after that realization, Hurricane Sandy comes barreling into New York City, emptying the Atlantic Ocean into the subway system, causing so much havoc, $30 billion worth of damage. You know, when we think about climate change, it seems to be this abstract, huge, monolithic, difficult thing to encounter. But the truth of it is, fighting climate change is not one big international battle. It is thousands and thousands of local fights, and they all have to be bound together and they all have to be won, like the fracking fight in New York State. That was a huge victory for the climate. We kept the equivalent of something like 55 million cars off the road by keeping that shale oil and shale gas in the ground. Those are the kinds of things right now that we have to do and escalate across the country, and that's why it's important to support local battles on both fracking and tar sands and pipelines and LNG terminals and all the ways in which the fossil fuel industry is expanding right now.
I did think you chose an interesting way to illustrate the creep of climate change, which you just mentioned, focusing on the trees, that one single tree that was dying, that was not just the story of hemlocks and forests, but it was very personal for you, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, I discovered it because a tree that I planted when I was 5 years old is dying of that Woolly adelgid parasite. But, you know, there's a tree metaphor that goes throughout the entire film. And, you know, that everything in a film, even if it's a documentary, is a metaphor for the larger world. And the truth is that if we don't take action and take action soon, and like right now, you know, to transform our civilization to more sustainable values, we're going to be in for a really nightmarish future. And I mean that because of the way that people will react to climate change, not necessarily the climate itself. In many ways, some of the most negative and difficult aspects of climate change are unstoppable at this point. We've already warmed the Earth by 1 degree. We probably have enough CO2 and methane and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and heat absorbed in the oceans to bring the temperature of the planet to 1.5 degrees. I'm talking Celsius. So for all intents and purposes, we're already at 1.5 degrees Celsius. The Paris targets in the most recent international agreement on climate change, the targets say we must keep the global warming well below 2 degrees. The reason why is because at 2 degrees, we bring about an unstoppable process that rises sea levels by 5 to 9 meters. That means say goodbye to New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Boston, Miami, New Orleans, Berkeley, Oakland, parts of L.A. All of our major coastal cities start to go underwater and go underwater in a big way. 5 to 9 meters is a lot of territory along the coasts, including a lot of, I will mention, power plants, nuclear power plants, as well as fossil fuel refineries and so on. All that material needs to get moved if we're not going to toxify the oceans. The United Nations predicts 800 million climate refugees if we hit 2 degrees. However, we're already at 1.5, which means that we basically have to turn off all fossil fuels right now if we're going to stay well below 2 degrees. That's pretty much impossible. So we know we're in for a hell of a ride coming in the future for us and for future generations in terms of, infectious diseases, moving towards more northern climates that normally stay in the tropics. The death of 30 to 50% of all the species on the planet as we watch coral reefs. Our forests getting more and more sick and dying. It's a really bleak picture, but to be honest, what we control of this is how we react to it both right now and in the future. Right now, the appropriate reaction is to get very political very fast about this and start to say to the government, we cannot have any more fracking. We cannot plan any more frack gas power plants. We cannot plan any more fossil fuel expansion. In fact, we have to do a 180-degree turn. We have to do it right now towards renewable energy. That is the actions that we must take right now. As we go towards the future, we also have to instill ourselves with a sense of sustainable values. Our culture right now, our whole society is based on some of the worst elements of humanity: greed, consumerism, institutionalized racism, violence, competition. These are the things that we base our civilization on now, and that is what's led us to this incredible, horrible fix that we're in. If we're going to withstand and go through the climate catastrophe that's coming with any shred of human dignity, we have to start to focus on our values. We have to start to focus on how do we strengthen human rights, democracy, community, love, resilience, innovation, creativity, courage. These are the kinds of things that we need going forward. And we need to become a society of participants instead of a society that is sitting back all the time and waiting for the next horrible thing to happen. We have to go out into the world. We have to get involved in politics, and we have to get involved in determining our future and taking away the current civilization from the fossil fuel industry and move towards renewable energy and sustainable development.
Talking to Josh Fox, the man behind the film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, that you can see on Saturday afternoon at 1 p.m. at the Little Theater. And Josh traveled to 12 countries, 6 continents, and at one point you ride along with guys picking up thousands of gallons of oil in buckets, risking their own health to do it in a desperate effort to save their community, to save a rainforest. You conclude that we can't really call some spills accidents because there's a difference between an accident and negligence. Tell our listeners where you went to tell that story and what you saw.
Well, you know, yes, and you're right, the film goes all over the world, and it is a trip all over the world. It goes to every continent where there are people from, you know, obviously Asia, Africa, Europe, North America, South America, Australia, and the South Pacific, and Iceland. But what you're mentioning right now is an oil spill that happened in the Amazon, a very routine spill. Spills happen in the Amazon rainforest all the time, even though it's the headwaters of the longest river on Earth, and we think of it as the most pure jungle, there are oil drilling operations all along the headwaters of the Amazon in Ecuador and in Peru. And there are 40-year-old pipelines that spill all the time. And, you know, we're also clear-cutting and deforesting the Amazon at an incredibly rapid rate, which is another big problem because the Amazon is the lungs of the world. So what we do see is we trek, you know, 12 kilometers into the jungle on one day to an incredible, you know, I mean, the foot. Unbelievable, going through the sunken forest and hand-carved traditional caves to sort of sneak in before the oil companies can find us. And then, yes, finding, you know, thousands of gallons of oil being picked up by workers who are not trained, who don't have proper hazard and safety equipment, and that, you know, they're trying desperately to keep the oil out of the water, and it's incredibly, incredibly tragic to see that. I will note, however, that in West Virginia and in Pennsylvania and all of the places in America where they are fracking, workers are not trained, and workers are not given the same, are not given safety equipment in much the same way as in the Amazon. This is not an exposition on some kind of native or primitive culture. Oil companies are oil companies. They treat their workers the same all over the world. In fact, the fatality rate for oil and gas workers in the United States is 8 times the national average. The illness rate, nobody knows, it's off the charts. We have I did an expose on workers and fracking industry called Gas Work, which you can see free at gasworkfilm.com. But, you know, the oil industry is criminally negligent because they know by not training their workers that they're exposing their workers to grave, grave health harms and in some cases even death. They know that a 40-year-old pipeline, which has not been maintained, which is submerged under the water, is going to leak and it's going to spill and it's going to rupture. And, in fact, in the United States in 2012 alone, we had 15 million gallons onshore fracking wastewater oil spills, a total of 50 million gallons of onshore contamination in the United States alone. That was not counted by the government. There is no agency that's tracking the spills that are happening onshore in the United States. It was done by a journalistic body at ENE Newswire. So, you know, look, I mean, the oil companies know very well what they're doing. They know very well that they contaminate aquifers when they drill through them. They know very well that they contaminate water supplies, both surface and underground drinking water supplies, when they frack. They know very well that they cause a health crisis wherever they go. So when you know you're doing something that's harmful, and you do it anyway, that is not just an accident. That's not a spill. That's not something, you know, spill happens when you reach and knock your glass of milk off the table when you're reaching for the corn and you accidentally hit something. That's a spill. This is a permanent state of criminal negligence for the oil industry because, and, you know, the bottom line is they would rather lawyer up and have thousands of lawyers. In some of their cases in South America, they literally have thousands of lawyers working to defend themselves against the toxic pollution that they have created. And it's a really sad state. It's the worst elements within us. It is the most greedy, selfish, litigious, and in many ways violent force on the planet. And they know very well what they're up to. We should not ever accept their explanations for what they're doing and simply say, get out of here. It's your time on planet Earth is over. We must go towards renewable energy, and we have to do that democratically. Because oil and gas, when it comes down to it, are the fuels of tyranny, whether that's the tyranny of the oil companies in South America or the tyranny of Vladimir Putin or the tyranny of somebody like Hillary Clinton, who's promoting fracking all over the world, whose constituents are oil, are Chevron and Shell and Exxon and not people. This is the problem. We have the oil companies getting in the way of the legal system, getting in the way of any kind of reliability, liability, culpability, because they buy our politicians and they lawyer up and they do not have the same sense of civic responsibility that any normal person living in a community has.
And so, Josh, before I let you go here, the film, again, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, you know, you are talking about your frustration with the tyranny of the industry as you see it, but what is the... Is there a single call to action more than any other? What do you hope viewers of your documentary walk away with?
Well, we hope they dance away. at the theater last night, even though we weren't there, we've been on tour all over America. We're doing something called the Let Go and Love Tour, and we're touring specifically to areas that are fighting off the fossil fuel industry. We're in Western Maryland today in a place called Frostburg, which is fighting fracking in Western Maryland. We've been all over the country fighting offshore drilling, onshore drilling, fracking, working with communities and their local groups because, in a sense, the touring and the film release and the way that it's happening right now is a grassroots activity. And, you know, we have a dance sequence that opens the film and a dance sequence that ends the film, and people have a tendency to get up and dance at the end of the movie because even though I'm saying all these incredibly harsh things about the oil industry and I'm saying all these incredibly depressing and horribly disturbing things about what's happening with the climate, there is a way to celebrate because human beings are the most innovative, creative, resilient, determined, enthusiastic, energized species that could ever be imagined. We have the capacity right now to, engage and connect inside of us to the best parts of us. And the end in the film, although it is dark in the beginning, it does connect throughout the whole latter half of the film with example after example of the most inspiring and incredible climate warriors that you'll ever meet on the face of the earth. I mean, I think, this film has greater superheroes than any Men in Tights movie you're going to see anywhere on in any multiplex in America. You see real heroes working in the real deep ways, and they never say die, and it's incredibly inspiring. So what I want people to do is to become inspired, to become re-energized, to be enthusiastic about fighting for their communities and fighting climate change. And the best way to do that is to join your local group. At our website, we do have an initial listing of local groups. We're going to be growing that list over the period of time. We want people to connect with their local chapter of 350.org or with their local anti-fracking organization or their local climate organization. There's the Citizens Climate Lobby. That's a national organization. 350.org, national organization. Or to form their own organizations that are participating in civil disobedience and participating in protests and getting involved in politics. Again, the only way we fix this is politics. It's not about changing your light bulb. It's not about buying an electric car. I mean, those things, yes, we have to do, but that will never be enough if we attack this on an individual basis. We must go forward as a community, as a collective. Climate change activism is a team sport, and the way you do that is you join your local group, and I believe that there may be some of those local groups tabling at the theater tonight in Rochester. I know that there'll be local groups tabling at all the places that we're playing across the nation, and again at our website, which is howtoletgomovie.com. howtoletgomovie.com. We have an initial list, state by state, of how you can take action and how you can take part. I'm not one of these filmmakers who's going to say, oh, just do one thing, click this link, switch your light bulbs. That is not adequate at this time. We must devote time to this. You must take an hour out of your week and say, I'm devoting that to climate change. I'm going to show up at my local group meeting. I'm going to go to that local hearing about the pipeline that we have to oppose that's going through our front yard. You know, this is the time now. And the good thing about that is when you get out of your house and when you go meet with people, whether that's at a group meeting or at a party or at a protest or something, that feels good. You're going to meet the best people you've ever met in your life. You're going to make the best friends you've ever made in your life at those meetings. That's changed my life. This tornado that called fracking that picked me up out of my backyard in PA, right on the border of New York State, for 8 years has taken me on the wildest ride of my life. I've met the best people I've ever met in my life. I have the deepest and most profound friendships because we're working on this issue together. You take that one step, and the road rises to meet your feet. That is the way this works. And you got to have faith and say, you know what? I'm standing up for humanity. I'm standing up for the planet. And I'm going to go work with my neighbors. That's what we want people to do. We want them to do it with a sense of joy and celebration. And that's what comes through in the movie. Even as despairing and as upsetting as it is, the depth of the emotion goes both ways. The depth of the sadness, the depth of the celebration. That's what we want people to come away with. So go to the film tonight, and then go to our website and see how you can sign up and see how your friends can see the movie. Anyone can request a community screen of the film. It will also be on HBO later in the month, so people will have, you know, universal access to this film. We want people to use it as a tool to get themselves mobilized and energized and enthusiastic.
And Josh, last quick question. I know you got to go. As I mentioned off the top, the New York Times called the film tough to watch but tough to ignore. Variety I think the one complaint Variety has is, you know, you focus on your concern with the fact that it's probably too late in many ways to stop the effects of climate change, but then you shift toward community activism and all the things that you just mentioned here on this program. But Variety says, as if those would prevent the immersion of New York and San Francisco that Josh Fox has worked so hard to foreshadow, they're sort of casting doubt.
The film, and let me stop you there because I don't read reviews. The worst people you could ever take advice for about movies are people who watch movies all day long. I mean, that's just crazy.
I think their question, though, is,
you know, to be honest, like I just don't read reviews and I don't really want to hear them. But what I'm hearing from you is that because they take the movie away from you and it's poisonous and it's just toxic. The reviews are their own form of toxicity. But what I'm saying is whether they're good or they're bad. I'll quote Katharine Hepburn. She didn't read reviews either. She said, well, the bad ones are bad, and the good ones, well, they're never quite good enough, are they? So that's the story on reviews. However, I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding to say that we're making a film to stop the immersion of New York City or the immersion of Philadelphia. That's not what we're doing. We're making a film so that when climate calamity happens, we react in a way that has human dignity. I'll tell you a little bit about this. You know, we may or may not have New York get submerged. We may or may not have Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Miami, all those cities. I mean, I think if we take action now, if we work as hard as we can now, and we actually talk about what's coming, there's the possibility of keeping those things from happening. However, what I will say is the likelihood is that they will happen. But remember, during Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina, a hurricane supercharged by climate change, that city went underwater. It was drowning. The poor and black people and the middle class people from New Orleans were drowning. And the mayor said, get on the bridge and get out of town. Walk on the bridge across the highway to the suburbs. And what happened? White suburban police on the other side were standing there with shotguns saying, go back and drown. And people got shot. Now that, at that moment, was not a climate change problem. That was a human rights problem. That was a civil rights problem. That was a collapse of human values and of American values. We can't always choose what happens to us. We can choose how we react. And the bottom line is climate will bring about real tests of our humanity. And those police that shot people on the bridge in Katrina to keep their white suburban neighborhood, empty of refugees from New Orleans, climate change, what I'm trying to say is climate change is not the moment to ready the extra shotgun and the extra round of shells. Climate change must provoke us to get ready the extra bedroom, to get ready the extra seat at the table, to welcome those who are in harm's way with humanity, with brotherhood, with a sense of family and community. Whatever Variety or New York Times has to say, I don't know. I know that they're good reviews and they always have something to say, but if they are that what I'm trying to do is keep New York above water. Well, yes, of course, any climate change activist wants to prevent the things that we know that are on the way. But more important than that, I'm making a film about humanity. I'm making a film about our values. And, that's the message. The message is we need courage. We need innovation. We need creativity. We need human rights. We need love. We need community. These are the things. Because, look, what is New York? New York is just a bunch of stuff, to be honest. Shakespeare wrote, what is the city but the people? If the people have to leave the city, the people are who we treasure, are who we value. The people is what creates life. That's what we have to focus on. If we're worried about, a bunch of our stuff is going to get drowned, well, what we should be worrying about is how are we handling the refugees? Where are we rebuilding? How are we rebuilding? Are we doing that with a sense of justice, or are we doing that with what Naomi Klein calls climate apartheid, where the poor people and the black people are shoved into refugee camps, meanwhile the rich are able to move to their second home. You see what I'm trying to say? We have to transform our society from a standpoint of values if we're going to get through the climate, if we start losing. We need those values in order to win, but we're going to need them even more if we start to lose.
Josh Fox's new film is How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. Thanks for taking the time to join the program, Josh.
Oh, I really appreciate your questions. Really, really wonderful to talk to you today. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. You can see the film still through tomorrow at the Cinemopolis in Ithaca. And you can see it Saturday at the Little Theater at 1 p.m. That's your chance to see the film in Rochester. Let's get a short break and come back and talk to our studio panelists who've had a chance to see the film and heard Josh's comments today, and we'll talk about related issues here to the film. Short break and more Connections next. Coming up in our second hour, a panel of transgender Americans talking about their experiences, particularly in light of some big recent news stories, from the North Carolina so-called bathroom bill to Orlando, and to the questions of the impact of celebrities in transgender culture. All of that with your questions and comments as well, next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You just heard from filmmaker Josh Fox. In studio with me is Brady Ferguson, member of the Rochester chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and Rachel Larson, a community solar catalyst for SED, that's Sustainable Energy Developments. And you might have heard earlier this hour, Rachel moved to Rochester from Portland in 2009, and she's had a chance to see and live in a city, Portland, that is considered one of the leading edge cities when it comes to local climate action, and kind of contrast that with what's going on here in Rochester. But first, let me ask our guests in studio, who just heard Josh Fox there. Rachel, he's pretty intense. He's got some strong views on where the world is going. What do you make of what you heard?
I think that Mr. Fox is a stereotypical environmentalist that turns folks, the average folks, person off to our message. So it's
too strong, too much for you?
Yeah, I think so. There's not enough hope. I would have loved for his film to start out with all the climate warriors in the world, just to not turn people off. I think that doesn't serve us well.
Okay. Brady, what do you think?
Well, one thing that I liked was that he touched on both mitigation and adaptation when he talked about climate change. Sometimes people say there's something of a debate between the two. Should we be focusing on adapting to climate change, or should we be focusing on trying to mitigate it? And the answer is that it has to be both, because as he said, there are already some effects of climate change that we're already starting to see that we're not going to be able to prevent from happening just because of the warming we've already seen happen. So we do have to be able to find ways to adapt to that. At the same time, to prevent it from getting even worse, we have to work on ways to use renewable energy and mitigate climate change from getting even worse than it already is.
I think that's an important point. I think he's certainly right that there are ways that climate is already impacting people right now. That sometimes we talk about climate in these abstract future terms as if, you know, we'll never see any of the impacts when we're already seeing some impacts. And I think that's a good point. I don't apologize for quoting the Variety Review in the interview, because I think the Variety Review made a good point. And Josh Fox, if he doesn't like it, as a filmmaker, should probably be more clear in his film. You know, what is the film about? And, you know, he was sort of ripping a review for not getting what the film was about instead of maybe looking a little inward. But I think the point that Brady makes is a good one here, and maybe Josh Fox could have spent more time with it being more explicit. That, okay, instead of being doom and gloom negative about, you know, we can't fix it, we can't, it's too late, you know, the ship has sailed, let's fix what we can, let's be positive about that, and then let's help people in need right now, and let's be positive about that. And Rachel, maybe that would have brought a little more sunshine into the film.
I do not disagree with his premise. I think that we are in a dire situation, but people turn off. They say, they throw up their hands, I can't do anything, so it's hopeless. What is my writing a letter going to make a difference in the big scheme of things? And that is not the message that the Rochester People's Climate Coalition or SED or any of our partners want to bring. We all have a place at the table. We all make choices every day that we can change our environment now and our environment for our children and our grandchildren. That's what we want folks to walk away with.
Yeah, and I think extracting one of the messages from Josh's film is that each community has its own climate issues. If you're in the Amazon, you have a different issue than if you're in Portland, than if you're in Rochester. than if you're in Beijing, which was, you know, he spent some time in China, where, as he said, 20 million people who never open the window. That's a very serious issue. And I think one of the messages to pull from that is the fact that each community can make their own steps and doesn't have to feel so disconnected. So I asked Rachel earlier this hour about contrasting Portland to Rochester. I just want to finish up with that because you had a lot of positive things to say about living in Portland, from how easy it was to compost, the encouraging things that the local government is doing to help people, whether it's very, very friendly to people who want to use alternative forms of transportation, bicycles and otherwise, composting, encouraging that kind of mentality. In Rochester, those wheels are starting to turn from what I'm reading and hearing. What do you see, and are you optimistic about what Rochester is doing on a policy level?
I am very optimistic, and I'm also knee-deep and trying to figure it out. The city of Rochester is working on their climate action plan, which mirrors the exact same thing as Portland, Oregon. And I was telling Evan earlier, I don't feel like they have the years, decades-long work and structure that they need to see that through, but their heart's in the right place, and we, as a climate coalition, are going to get them there. So that's very exciting. Right now in the city of Rochester, you can pay to have compost picked up at the curb. We would love to see that for every citizen of Rochester without having to pay. But if you have the money, you can spend that money on something that you value.
Okay.
Those are very exciting things. SED, the company that I work for, last week launched our first community solar array. Our first pilot array will offer solar energy to folks that live in apartments or that don't have the right roof or have the beautiful shade tree that they can't cut down because it means so much to their family. So that is a step. Everybody pays their electricity bill. Now you can pay it and buy green energy. That's exciting to us.
Okay, just some examples of what we're seeing. And we will certainly be in touch with the city of Rochester, I think, later this year. I think we're going to be hearing more publicly about what they're doing behind the scenes. And so we'll make sure that you're in touch with that. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on what you've been hearing, we've got some time to talk. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We'll start with Jane. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan, I was really glad to hear some passion because we've had time to get going on this. We had the Inconvenient Truth with Al Gore. I thought, now this will do it. It will wake people up, raise their consciousness, and not nearly enough has been done. So if this throws a few people into panic, I say good for them. They should be scared, not so scared that you can't take up arms against climate change, but there are plenty of people who are simply asleep, and I don't want them to go back to sleep or for you to mitigate in any way the need for action. And yes, we do. With Hillary Clinton, we need to be very loud. I don't hear people taking her to task about her fracking policies or values, and that's missing in this election coming up. So, you know, Hillary, for one, well, that's an example. Let's hold her feet to the fire. So, anyway, I want people to wake up, and I think this film might very well do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. Regarding Hillary Clinton and this election, there certainly have been some questions in debates. You saw Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton give very different responses about fracking, as just one example. I think, you know, everyone's going to have a different view slightly, and Jane clearly thinks we need to see more of a focus on environmentally based questions, climate-based questions in the course of the campaign, in interviews. You know, and it can start with, by the way, Hillary Clinton offering more press availability. That would help because she's going to be the nominee, and that would certainly help. But I think, to Jane's point, I think you will see more. You will certainly see Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton asked about it, Gary Johnson as well, and maybe Jill Stein as well, asked about climate issues in the debates and elsewhere. The question is, how much is the focus? And Jane clearly wants to see more. What do you guys think? Brady, what do you think?
Yeah, I think climate change needs to be an important issue in this election. But really, the president only can do so much. I mean, Obama came out with the power plant regulations. But really, when you talk about having a more significant impact on climate change and decreasing emissions, it has to come from Congress, because that's where the new laws have to come from. Now, as a member of Citizens Climate Lobby, which has chapters all over the country, we are pushing hard with members of Congress and senators to get legislation passed to institute a carbon tax, which we feel is really going to be the most effective way to decrease emissions. In particular, we propose the carbon fee and dividend proposal, which is a way to have the carbon tax, return it to taxpayers as a dividend, a way to make it revenue neutral, actually help grow the economy while decreasing the emissions. But we're really pushing the members of Congress, because it has to come from there rather than the president.
It's worth, by the way, if you hear the term carbon tax or carbon fee and dividend, looking it up and researching more before you form any judgments about it. And I'm not trying to sell it one way or another. I'm simply saying sometimes people hear the term tax, they have an immediate assumption. But whether it's Dr. James Hansen or Tim McGowan and others who've been on this program, a lot of the focus on a carbon tax or a carbon fee and dividend is returning some of that tax to the taxpayers and encouraging innovation sort of away from, you know, kind of fossil fuels and other forms of energy. So anyway, it probably bears its own discussion. It probably bears its own hour, but it is worth focusing on there. Let me grab some more phone calls, because every phone line's lit up. Rich in Rochester. Next up. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, my point is, one point I want to make is that we talk about, like, Brazil, Africa, and everything, but in looking at our country, we've wiped out, if I'm not mistaken, like 90% of our temperate forest. Why don't we move to restore some of those forests? It'd be at 10-15%. Make that a national goal. Make our biodiversity, our grasslands. Start restoring what we can restore. We keep looking at others, but yet we don't want to do the heavy lifting in many ways. And that's what I see.
So, but Rich, are you saying that, you know, for example, this film, and I'll mention it again if you're just joining us, we talked to a filmmaker earlier this hour behind a new documentary called How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. You can see it in Ithaca through tomorrow, and you can see it at the Little Theater at 1 p.m. on Saturday afternoon here in Rochester. Rich, are you saying, you know, it's sort of fruitless, or at least it's a waste of time right now to focus on what's happening in the Amazon and Beijing, and you'd like
Okay. No, I'm not saying that it's a waste of time at all. But what I'm saying is that we keep pointing there, but we're not pointing at ourselves. Why don't we restore our temperate forest, the great hardwood forest of the United States, the great grasslands that would go a long way to help mitigate these problems? Instead, we just talk about not doing that, but what other people are doing right now. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a two-pronged attack, but we need, as a country, start looking at ourselves and making, okay, we want to restore our at least 20 or 30% of our great forests that we used to have in this country. We want to restore X number of hectares of grasslands, natural grasslands. Why don't we talk to that? Those are things that we can do in this country.
All right, Rich. Let me just jump in, Rich, and say I think that point is well made. I mean, certainly our country is not devoid of its own questions on how we could behave with the land. I'll ask our guests what they think. Brady Ferguson, what do you think?
Yeah, he makes a good point that we should look inward before blaming others, you know, before blaming China for all their emissions and burning coal. We should look at what we're doing right here in the U.S., but also looking at the corporations we're supporting here that are going and doing this stuff in other countries.
Yeah, and I think in many ways Josh Fox is doing that. I wouldn't say this film, and from what you've seen, do you get the sense that this film is avoiding any inward looking? I don't think so.
No.
What do you think?
I definitely don't think so. I completely agree. I think there's so much that we could be doing. What it takes is people demanding that we do it. Our governments, our local nonprofits could be out planting trees right now, but we have to have the people energy, and we have to build that hope and the infrastructure for folks to do those great things.
All right, Jerry in Pittsford next up, and let's keep it moving because we've got a lot of phone calls to try to get through. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yes, Evan, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I saw the film last week in Geneva, and I loved it. It was both intense and inspiring. And I loved the way at the end that Josh Fox said it's important to do whatever we can on a local level and just to do our part, just to take that one first step in action. But my question is to your guest, Brady, with the Citizens Climate Lobby Group. I'm interested in that carbon fee and dividend proposal. My question is, to get it something like that passed, it would have to be agreeable to people on both sides of the aisle. And I wondered, Brady, what has been the what do people on both sides of the aisle in Congress think of this this presentation of this proposal? Are they for it, or is one side for it more than the other? Or how's that going?
Jerry, it's a good question. Thanks for the phone call, Brady.
Yeah, thank you for the question. As most people would probably guess, it's a lot more favorable among Democrats than Republicans. Actually, last week there was a vote in the House, a resolution that said that expressing the sense of Congress that a carbon tax would be detrimental to the economy, and that did pass the House 237-163, basically a vote along party lines. Republicans said yes, Democrats said no. However, there is some reason for hope because we do have things happening like the Gibson resolution, where you have Congressman Gibson from New York State, along with 12 other Republicans who all are coming out and saying climate change is harmful. It's something we have to act on. You have the Climate Solutions Caucus, started by two congressmen from Florida, one Democrat, one Republican, and they're working on adding more members to that group, both Democrats and Republican. So we have a ways to go, but we are making progress with getting people on both sides of the aisle to actually support that. Because as the members of Congress from Florida said, when you have water flooding the streets in Miami, that's not a partisan issue.
Yeah, and to respond a little bit to one of the callers earlier who didn't necessarily agree with Rachel Larson about whether this Josh's tone is too aggressive, too off-putting, look up the work of Brendan Nyhan. He has looked at confirmation bias. He has looked at the way people respond to new information on climate. And what he finds is presenting them information, particularly in aggressive ways, generally only hardens their views. I don't think Rachel Larson is saying we shouldn't be passionate about climate or that you shouldn't try to convince people it's important. It's a question of what works. And we're starting to see some alarming things about what people do with facts and evidence. So, I think of that in response to Brady saying, you know, you've got a number of people in Congress who are passing resolutions against any sort of a tax, a carbon tax. I'm not endorsing a carbon tax as a host of the show, but you're not going to get them on board until you find new ways to reach them. And I think that's just sort of the reality right now. So can a film like this do it? Maybe with some, maybe not with everybody. Bob and Menden, go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. Just a comment. There's a Native American expression that goes, we don't own the world, we're borrowing it from our grandchildren. And I think if everyone were to kind of live according to that, that would be a fantastic first start.
Well, simply said, Bob. You know, you get big smiles from both of our guests here. Not much to add to that, huh?
Nope, complete agreement.
Brady, yeah?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, Kate on Twitter says, let's not pave every piece of green space we have. Still trying to happen in Henrietta. We're trying to stop it. Thank you for the show. Well, thank you, Kate, for writing in. Let me try to grab one more phone call. Tim in Rochester. Go ahead, Tim. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. Are you there, Tim? Okay, I don't have Tim, but we'll find a way to get back to Tim in the future. Bob in Rochester, against my better judgment, I'm going to take a call. You've got about 30 seconds. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, I just wanted to mention something that people can do to act locally and have global impact, which is join the fight We Are Seneca Lake. And you can do that by going on wearesenecalake.com and clicking on the tab Join Us. You can also follow We Are Seneca Lake on Twitter and Facebook.
Bob, thanks for the phone call. And Joseph Campbell, who helps head up some of the efforts down there, has been on this program, and I've been in touch with him recently about what's going on with LPG storage and other related issues, and we will explore that. By the way, I will also point out, we have many, many times reached out to the energy companies involved with efforts to expand, whether it was fracking in the past or LPG storage, and that is an open invitation. So we would love to have Crestwood out of Houston or related companies on this program. So far they have declined, but I'm going to continue to try to do that because we do want their voice in the discussion too. But you've got a chance to see the film that we've been talking about, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. If you're in Ithaca or the Finger Lakes, Ithaca Cinemopolis is showing it through tomorrow, and one showing in Rochester at the Little Theater on Saturday at 1 p.m. So that's your chance there. They're also online, as you heard from Josh Fox, the filmmaker, earlier. And look at that. Time flies when the phone is going crazy and you've got people who want to talk climate. And so we'll continue to have these discussions. I want to thank our panelist, Brady Ferguson. He's a member of the Rochester chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Are you guys online, by the way, if people want to reach out to the Climate Lobby? Go ahead.
Yes, citizensclimatelobby.org. At Citizens Climate on Twitter.
Thanks very much for being here, Brady.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Larson, Community Solar Catalyst for SED, that's Sustainable Energy Developments. They've been on the program before. This is Rachel's first time. Nice to meet you here in studio, and thanks for coming in, Rachel.
Thanks. And I would just like to say, GoSolarRochester.com. Make that choice for green energy and do something for the climate that you can feel good about.
All right, short break. Much more connections is next.